Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the third week of September. This week we have as our main topic a rebroadcast of a show from early last year, an interview that we did with Cindy Daly from Discovery Bay Wild Bird Rescue on her very interesting and valuable work. I'm also pleased to have sound engineer Charlie Fleischman here to help me this week with observations and events. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you, Deborah. Always a pleasure to read with you.
Oh, thank you. But before we get to that, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. A hint for this one is that it comes from the sea. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is.
One of the most notable things about this week is the arrival of the autumnal equinox on the 23rd of September. If you did not sense the change in the weather already, this is the official start to fall, with day length beginning to shorten from the 23rd until the winter solstice. Equinox is from the Latin, equus meaning equal and nox meaning night. For on this date, day and night are of almost equal length. Another interesting fact about the equinox is that on this day, no matter where you are in the world, the sun will be directly above you at noon, and the sun will generally rise due east and set due west, so it's a good time to correctly orient yourself. Go to earthsky.org for more interesting bits about the equinox and other astronomical phenomena. It's a good day to get centered.
Speaking of orienting, specialists in this art can be seen right now in many of our rivers and streams on the Olympic Peninsula, with salmon coming up them to spawn. This has been greatly aided by our recent rains. To quote from Tom Fairhall, "The east side rivers look like they have just come alive with fish." He describes never having seen so many salmon running as he did on a recent hike up the Duckabush River. The interim nature trail up to Ranger Hole, on Forest Service land just south of Brinnen, is an especially good place to see the fish leaping up the white water to the river above the falls. Our thanks to the Peninsula Daily News for this update.
And speaking of fall, Jeff Hammerson sent us some beautiful photos of the lowbush huckleberries starting to turn their usual gorgeous red and orange shades in the subalpine zone. The sad news is that this beautiful foliage is usually accompanied by plump and delicious purple berries, but not this year. The summer drought has left the plants virtually without berries this year, much to our chagrin, and that of the bears.
Oh. Jeff also sent us a wonderful photo synopsis of other natural history news. He found an adult Encinitas salamander under some wood, and if you don't know them, they look rather like very moist, slender, and smooth-skinned, rough-skinned newts, which people know pretty well from seeing them crossing the roads. But these lungless salamanders are completely terrestrial and have no aquatic phase. This is the beginning of their mating season, which will continue in mild weather through the winter and into the spring.
Western thatching ants continue to enlarge their nest mounds with Douglas fir needles, bits of moss, and tiny twigs. These native beneficial ants prey upon other insects and also consume aphid secretions. Northwestern deer mice are starting to enter buildings and other structures in increasing numbers in preparation for colder weather. So now would be a good time to make those last-minute home repairs to keep them outside where they belong.
And in other terrestrial mammal news, last month I spoke about how non-native possums were finally being recorded in the Port Townsend area. And then a couple of days ago, I saw my first one dead by the side of the center road, halfway between Quilcene and Chimicum. It seems that possums will be a much more common sight in our area in the future. And now we are happy to present an encore of part one of our interview with wildlife rehab specialist Cindy Daly of Discovery Bay Wild Bird Rescue. So if you're like me, there are few things that are more distressing than to see an animal in need and not know how to help them. My guest today serves the very important function of knowing what to do and is here to share some of her insights with us. Thanks so much for coming to speak with us about your work, Cindy.
Thank you for having me.
Cindy Daly is founder of the Discovery Bay Wild Bird Rescue. And when I first met Cindy many years ago, she was doing wildlife rescue work out of her home in central Port Townsend. It was a magical place to visit, as you would never know what you would find there. New aviaries cropping up in various parts of the yard, river otters playing in the inflatable kiddie pool, injured or orphaned animals nestled in various dark nooks inside the house. You've since moved to a place that's a bit farther out of town, right?
Yes, we're currently located on 5.5 acres, just outside of town, closer to the airport.
Oh, and I am really looking forward to going to see you there. It's a really cool thing to see birds that are recovering and being returned to the wild.
Well, we're just so happy to have a little more room so we don't have to shove things into little nooks and crannies.
Yeah. Well, and if you have something like an eagle in, it really needs some room.
Yes, we're busy building lots of enclosures and making space for everyone.
Oh, good. Well, maybe we should start by having you define for us what wildlife rehab is.
Well, I came to understand wildlife rehabilitation and get involved in it back in the 80s when I was studying biology at the university in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I didn't realize that there was a way to participate in helping wild animals recover from injuries and also be a part of an educational process that we can use to go out and teach people about what is happening with our wildlife. So in order to get involved, I was a volunteer and spent a lot of time apprenticing to people who had already been through their programs and had training and learned what to do. You start with very common birds like perhaps your English house sparrow, your pigeon, or your starling. And as you learn to treat injuries and you learn diets and you learn the proper way to house things, you start to experience more birds as their faith in you grows, and you start to learn how to do more and more. At a certain point, you hope to get enough experience that you're able to take an examination that you get from the state that you're choosing to work in, and then you are able to put in for your own permits and go strike out on your own to have a wildlife rehabilitation facility. But there's a lot involved. You have to build the appropriate housing and be inspected and have quite a bit of information under your belt before you ever get started on your own.
Yeah, it's not as simple as just cuddling up to an animal and knowing instinctively what to do. Well, the different species have very different requirements.
Absolutely, and there's a lot to learn about each one, and you have to be able to give each thing what it needs to respond well to recover enough to be released. And I think years ago, many, many years ago, I'm sure lots of people have tried to raise those baby birds that they have found or those baby bunnies and have come to realize that it's not as easy as you think.
Yeah, it's very true. When I first met you, you were taking in a variety of different species of wildlife. Are you now specializing in birds?
I am. For some of the reasons we just spoke about, I wanted to kind of immerse myself in what the birds need and not spread myself so thin, trying to do all species, including mammals and reptiles and so on. So I've concentrated on birds. I want to make sure that I can give them all that they need.
Uh-huh. So if we find other species of wildlife in trouble, who are the best people to contact?
Well, Sarah Penhaligan at Center Valley Animal Rescue down in Squim has received her permits to take in wild mammals. So she is now taking care of our deer and raccoons and coyotes and bobcats, those sorts of things, rabbits and squirrels as well. So if you find something like that injured and you need help, I would call her.
And Jay Moore also in Squim, she takes a variety of different species, right?
Absolutely. Jay is also a wonderful rehabilitator who's been doing it for more than 30 years. She's taken in everything you can think of, all mammals and bird species. And
she's a remarkable person, too. I've known her for decades also.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun, and she does a great job. And she, along with Sarah and myself, are trying to take care of all the things that are on the Olympic Peninsula. So all the counties involved and we're kind of working together. We're traveling back and forth all of the time. So if something does come in and it's a mammal and you can't find Sarah, you can call me and I will get it to Sarah and Jay as well. We're all working together and trying to take care of all the things that we get calls on.
Oh, that's great. Does Chimicum Valley Vet do any rehab work anymore? Dr. Tony Rogstad and his wife Jeanette used to take a lot in, and the whole community has been so sad when he passed away.
Absolutely. Dr. Tony and Jeanette made huge contributions to our community by taking care of wildlife for so many years. They did a tremendous amount, and there was a hole they're definitely missed, and that's where Sarah and I came along and kind of stepped into that vacancy, and we're trying to fill some very big shoes right now.
Yeah, well, we're thankful that you're there to do it. Marine mammals are in a category of their own, though, right? The Port Townsend Marine Science Center coordinates the marine mammal stranding network for this area.
Absolutely. It's definitely a specialty that I'm not involved in, and you do need to contact the right person for that, and it would be the Marine Science Center, yes.
Okay. When does the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife get involved?
Well, they're a wonderful agency that comes to my aid sometimes when I need a little law enforcement. You know, there are times when someone finds something and they maybe don't want to give it up quite readily. And sometimes they have to step in and confiscate a bird. It's a hard thing to do. And people get very attached to something because they're trying to save it. They mean well, but they're not ready to give it up. And really, for the bird's sake or the animal's sake, it's the right thing to do, to give it to the proper person who knows what's best for the bird.
And who can hopefully return it to the wild.
Yeah, the point is,
wild creatures are not meant to be pets.
No, absolutely not. The point is, get them back into the wild. And so sometimes Fish and Wildlife have to step in and help us in that law enforcement capacity. In other ways, they might help out if we were to get a call on say, perhaps a bobcat that got caught in a fence. That's a big rescue to try to do and take on. And sometimes you need those extra hands on deck, you know, to rescue something like that. And they're always willing to come to our aid.
But they're pretty thin on the ground too. So that's why it's so great that you guys have the skills to help wildlife, because there aren't many fish and wildlife folks out there to call in.
That is very true. They rely on us, I think, a great deal.
So back to your chosen specialty birds. What are the most common species that you deal with, and what types of injuries or problems are most commonly encountered?
I see a lot of birds that have been hit by cars.
Oh, and maybe this would be a time for you to tell us about Darwin. He's patiently sitting there waiting for us to talk about him. And he was hit by a car, right?
He was. It's a common injury in owls and a lot of raptors. They get fixated on their prey, something that they're going to have for dinner, and they fly down sometimes right in front of a car, and they, of course, are hit. We see a lot of hit-by-car injuries in raptors. In Darwin's case, he lost his left eye. Oh, there's always a question about whether or not a one-eyed owl might be releasable and be able to survive in the wild. But one sure way to find out is to give him his prey, his mice, alive and see if he has any interest in hunting. And in his case, he just was not interested. He ignored them for days and days. And so I suspect there might be a little bit of a hearing loss involved with his head injury as well.
Uh-huh.
And so he showed no interest in hunting, which made him a perfect candidate to become an educational ambassador, if you will, and to come out and meet people and let you, for one, see him up close and appreciate how beautiful they are.
Yeah, he is about the size of a hand. I mean, he's amazingly compact. And even though I have seen them before, I've never seen one this close at hand, and it is such a privilege to see a wild creature this close up.
Well,
even though it makes me really sad that he has lost an eye and no longer back in the wild, it's great that he can serve as an ambassador.
Yes, he definitely serves another purpose, and he's very comfortable in captivity. He does quite well and is happy to receive his dinner every night, and he doesn't have to work too hard for it.
Yeah.
Just to finish answering your question, we see animals tangled in wire. I see animals that are birds that have hit windows. I see a lot of cat caught and dog caught birds. Those are some of the more typical injuries. Sadly, it's rare for me to run across something that is just a natural accident. Most things are man-made.
Connected to some of our activities in some way.
Yeah, and affect wildlife. Mm-hmm.
So do you end up getting a definite peak of activity in the spring and early summer when birds are at the peak of their breeding season?
I do. I receive a lot of calls on baby birds that have fallen or left their nests. It's quite common for a fledgling bird who has feathers on them to fall to the ground when they're still trying to learn to fly. And they might spend a couple of days on the ground, which of course makes them completely vulnerable to be caught by your pet dog or your pet cat. But the best thing to do for them really is to put them back in the nest if at all possible. And if not possible, if you can't reach the nest, it's always good.
You were telling me about a great trick of how to build a nest. If you can't get it back to the nest that it dropped from, that you can build a nest.
Absolutely. Build a nest. And to do that, just get a small box. Find a margarine tub-sized bowl, put some holes in the bottom because you don't want it filling with water, put some tissue in the bowl and stick that bowl in the box, and then just take that box and nail it to the tree as close to the original nest as you possibly can. And just kind of watch, keep an eye. Most of the time, the parents, if the bird is able to stay warm on its own, it's got feathering already, it can be fed by the parents. They can split their time between two nests.
And that's where it's critical that it has some feathers on it still, because then it'll stay warm on its own and the parent will feed it, but it won't have to sit on the nest and then split its time between the nest that still has young in it and this little artificial nest box.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Yes. If the bird is completely naked and can't be put back in the nest, then these are the ones that come to me. And yeah. I spend most of the spring and summer raising those kinds of birds. Birds that are injured, birds that can't be put back in nests, that can't regulate their own body temperature, come to me. And I typically am having to find different hand feeding formulas depending on what type of bird it is. So it's also important for people to, you know, if they're going to find a bird, they get it to me and I identify the species so I get the right diet into the bird. And that entails feeding every 30 minutes. And that's for about a 12-hour period, 12 to 14 hours a day.
It's amazing. Until the bird, if it's diurnal, until it goes to sleep, basically,
right.
Mm-hmm. Until the sun goes down.
Yes. So that is a very busy time for rehabbers, spring and summer.
Yeah. Wow. So I've also heard that the fall is a peak time to find birds, as immature birds that are migrating get really stressed and get lost. Is that right?
Yes. The fall is a time when first-year birds especially run into problems. They might not be hunting as well as they, you know, should be, and they're starving. They're going to run into accidents as they're moving through territories trying to find their own and establish one. It's just a very difficult time in the fall, in the winter, as birds are moving through here, too, on migration.
Yeah.
So, yes, I will see a lot of first-year birds, older birds, weakened birds from storms, all of those things.
Uh-huh. So along with rehabbing birds, I know that one of your main goals is to educate the public, not only telling them or telling us where to bring birds in to get help, but also how to prevent them from needing help in the first place. Would you please summarize for us what the main things are that we can do to keep our birds healthy and ease your caseload of injured birds?
Yes, Devron, I'm glad you asked. I think that it's very helpful to have things on your windows if that window is a problem and you're having a lot of bird strikes. There's so many materials out there nowadays that people can buy and put up. And if you don't want to buy something that flutters or waves in the wind, I know one lady who just used stickers and
those little post-it notes.
Those little post-it, colored post-it notes and stickers and things, and they decorated the window with the kids, and it really helped keep the birds from hitting the window.
And because you don't need them there for very long, right? You just need them through the season where they're the peak breeding season or the peak fledging season.
Yes,
and then you can take them down.
Sometimes it's just there's an active period, and then other times some people unfortunately have windows that just attract birds, and it's a good way to keep that help that problem. And then of course during the time when birds are nesting and fledglings are coming down to the ground, if people want to try to keep their pets inside, their dogs and their cats, for those few days when they know if they see a bird down in their yard, you know, that's important too. And poisons, remember, when you're using rat poisons and things, you're not just killing the rats, but you might be harming the hawks and the owls that are so important to our environment, who are preying on those things and trying to keep those populations down for you.
Yeah. And it's also really important in terms of spreading disease for people to keep their bird feeders clean, and also not to take trees and snags and shrubs down in the nesting season, right?
Sure. And yes, that's a really good point, to prevent diseases, to try to keep your bird feeders and your and the area clean as possible, and try to keep the seed from getting wet so that you're not infecting the birds with salmonella. And yes, and all of those things are really great tips for people who want to keep their birds healthy.
Thanks so much, Cindy, for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
I would like to add that fall is an especially busy time for all the wildlife rehab folks in our area. Young animals dispersing are especially vulnerable to all kinds of pressures, especially birds, with their often amazingly long migrations. It is also a time when the animals that have been healed or raised in the rescue centers are often ready to be re-released into the wild. I was just up visiting with Jay Moore at the Northwest Raptor and Wildlife Center in Squim last week and got to see some adorable northern saw-whet and western screech owls that were about to be released. Jay said that they had seen more small owls at the center this year than in several past years, mostly young owlets that had fallen out of the nest and had been brought in for help. Our sincere thanks go out to all of these amazing rehab folks for all of their hard work on all of our behalves.
There are a number of upcoming natural history events to tell you about. The Jefferson Land Trust has a work party planned in Quilcene on Thursday, September 24th at the Lower Donovan Creek Preserve. Come explore this cool property and help them pull invasive weeds starting at 10 a.m. Go to their website at saveland.org for more details.
The Dungeness River Festival is happening this weekend, which this year also commemorates the 100th anniversary of the bridge. The event starts on Friday, but most of the activities are planned for Saturday the 26th and take place at the Dungeness River Audubon Center just outside of Squim. It's a great, free, family-friendly event. Go to DungenessRiverCenter.org for more details.
The Port Townsend Marine Science Center has another of their grand fall bird migration cruises planned for Saturday, September 26th from 1 to 4 p.m. Join them by going to their website at ptmsc.org to book a spot.
Lastly, this Saturday is National Public Lands Day. All of our state parks are free on that day and will not require the usual Discover Pass. So go out and enjoy yourselves. Or better yet, go volunteer some time making your favorite park an even better place. And here's our mystery sound again. It's a common murre, with the sound played an adult calling to its chick at sea, though they are generally silent outside the breeding season. I chose it because common murres are, sadly, much in the news of late, as they are currently experiencing a wreck along our outer coasts, from Alaska to California. A wreck is what biologists call an unusual die-off event among seabirds, and finding an unusually high number of dead and dying birds washed up along the coast is usually what keys biologists into the fact that something is wrong. Our friend Meg Amos and her daughter Emily saw this firsthand as they hiked up the coast on their backpacking trip in the Lake Ozette area a couple of weeks ago, stopping their count at 50 dead murres. Seeing dead birds washed up along the beach is fairly normal for this time of year, as there is high mortality among the young birds that are dispersing from their breeding colonies. But the numbers of them are unusually high this year, about 3 to 6 times the number that is usual, according to Dr. Julia Parrish, an expert in seabird ecology and head of the University of Washington's Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team, otherwise known as COAST. The cause of death is starvation, but what is causing that is presently a raging controversy. We'll keep you posted as we learn more. Our thanks to Cornell University's great CD collection, Bird Songs of the Pacific Northwest, for that recording. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the third week of September. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptze.org. As always, happy trails!
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is Equinox. The artist, Eric Hansen.